You're listening to Alien X Radio, and this is your afternoon interview. All right, on the line right now, I've got my guest, Caitlin Ohini. You might know her from the television show Tales of the Gold Monkey. She's an actress, and how you doing tonight?
I'm doing fabulous. How are you?
I'm not doing fabulous, but I'm doing pretty good. fabulous is good.
Fabulous.
Yes.
You know, pretty good is only pretty good. You want to be fabulous.
How are things going in New York right now?
Well, things are going fantastic, and we've begun to have winter. We had our first snow yesterday morning. It was gorgeous, and it's all melted now, but it's freezing out, and it's wonderful. And you know, I'm kicking my agent to get me more work. I just completed a movie this past summer called Late Phases, directed by the wonderful Adrian Garcia Bogliano. You might see it there on my IMDb page.
Yeah, you played a part of Emma?
Yeah. It'll be released in 2014, and I was just so... It was just such a wonderful experience. I worked with the greatest actors, Luciana Alda and Tom Noonan and Lance Guest and, oh gosh, the list goes on and on. Tina Louise, actually. Do you remember Tina Louise? you don't seem to remember her, but that's okay.
it would go by, I kind of know characters' names first, and then I learn... Like the actors' real names afterwards. I'm kind of bad about that.
Okay, yeah, I understand. So then you know me as Sarah Stickney White.
Right. that's what sticks in my mind the most. Yep. Now
you know go ahead.
When you're going back to that character right now, you're talking about, of course, Tales of the Gold Monkey. And how much fun was that? I mean, that show was like, you had a lot of locations, I would imagine, where you had to travel around to film this?
No, not at all. We shot the pilot in Hawaii. And
that was rough.
That was rough, I got to tell you. We shot the pilot in Hawaii. And, you know, you never know whether the pilot's going to be picked up or not. So they don't like to spend too much money on the pilot. So you'll notice that from the pilot to the first episode, Sarah's clothes significantly improved. They brought in, I don't want to forget his name because he was such an amazing costume designer, Jean-Marie. Oh, I feel so bad. Oh, my gosh, somebody should spank me for forgetting his name. He researched the dress style in the 1930s, and he actually designed and made for me absolutely perfect reproductions. Like, for at that time, they used to put a penny in the back of a dress to keep it from the wind from making it flap. And he did that. I actually bought a few of my costumes, and I made sure to buy that one with the penny sewed in to keep it hanging down. And, he was so wonderful. Anyway, it'll come to me after we hang up. I know that.
That's when it usually does, yeah.
But no, actually, we only went on location for the pilot to Hawaii, and all the rest of it was done on set at Universal Studios, and we had a mock-up Grumman Goose, the plane, and they had second unit. Now, second unit, of course, cost them quite a bit of money, because then they had to find a real Grumman Goose, and you know, shoot all the exteriors and all that. But every set was built every single week. The monkey bar, well, that was permanent. That was there. But all those jungle scenes and all that kind of stuff, those sets were built every single week. It was an exhausting show. We all worked between 18 and 20 hours a day, and I am not exaggerating. But it was Don Delisario's vision. And Don Delisario, as we all know, was a prolific writer and producer, and he knew what he wanted, and he got it. And working with Stephen and Roddy and Jeff, Ron Moody, who actually played the first Bone Schultz Louie in the pilot, he was great, too. He was fantastic. I never really knew why they replaced him with Roddy, but even so, when Roddy came in, Roddy was amazing. And Leo the dog! Oh, my God, I've got such a story about Leo, if you want to hear it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you the dog's name. Is Leo, you said?
Yeah, well, in the script, his name, right. His name was Leo because that was his name. And he was amazing. As I said, Don Delisario had a vision, and he knew exactly what he wanted. So he really was specific that he wanted a Jack Russell Terrier. And it had to be a dog that was able to be trained. And he searched everywhere and then finally found the dog that he wanted in Australia, okay?
Wow.
No, but listen, that wasn't Leo. As they were taking the dog out of the car at the airport, probably it must have been in Sydney, I would think, to fly the dog to Los Angeles to begin shooting the pilot, the dog was hit by a car and killed.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So Don gets this phone call the day before shooting, or the day before we're supposed to leave for Hawaii or whatever, that this beautiful dog was just killed. They rushed to an animal shelter in Burbank, California. And there was Leo, and Leo was on death row. Because this was not a no-kill shelter. And Leo was already, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old? So they rescued Leo. And they brought him. He learned everything. I mean, and he wore the eye patch. But we were not allowed, which I hate because I'm a huge animal lover, as you'll see. You know, I'm vegan. I'm total animal rights. I adore animals. I adore dogs. But we were not allowed to have any interaction whatsoever with him. Because the trainer wanted all of his attention to be, I think it was a woman, I hope I'm not offending anybody, but I think it was a woman. She wanted all of her attention, all of Leo's attention to be on her. And so we could not even pet him, talk to him, pay any attention to him whatsoever. But wasn't he brilliant?
Yeah, he was. And I've actually heard that a lot, though, that the trainers don't let anybody have interaction with the animals because they do have to be able to... stay focused on who's giving them the stage cues and things to do, you know. Otherwise, they can't perform.
Right. We had a beautiful, I think it was a Black Shepherd, I think it was, on Late Phases, the movie I just did. And the same thing. We were not allowed to have any interaction with that dog at all. But so isn't that an amazing story, how Leo's life was saved?
Yeah.
And he became a TV star?
It was, you know, rose to become a TV star and saved and everything out of a tragedy. So it turned a tragedy of one, you know, poor dog into saving the life of another one. So, yeah, that life kind of evens itself out a little bit sometimes.
I know. It was truly amazing. I was very sad that Don made the decision not to go with a second season because ABC actually ordered a second season. And the story I was told is that Don was just didn't want to fight with them anymore about concept because originally, if I'm talking too much about this, tell me. I mean,
that's what it's about.
Okay, terrific. Don originally, the original script I got for the audition was just like a movie out of the 30s, you know. And he based it on the Cary Grant, Gene Arthur movie, Only Angels Have Wings. And, of course, you know, Stephen was the Cary Grant, and I was the Gene Arthur character. And then because of the success of Indiana Jones, ABC saw this as an opportunity to mimic you know, Indiana Jones, and they really wanted an action adventure, whereas Don really wanted a relationship based series. And so in order to sell it, he had to make changes to his concept. And so what I was told was the reason why Don decided not to go forward with the second season was because he just couldn't argue anymore every week with the writers and ABC about the concept. I mean, it was action and adventure, and every single week we had another, you know, crisis of something, cannibals or whatever. I remember in one of the very, very, very final episodes, Stephen and I were sitting in the mock-up of the Grum and Goose. And, of course, I don't remember what episode it was. It was one right near the end of the season. And you know, as an actor, you have to generate motivation for your character. And if you're faced with tragedy, if you're faced with a situation of being eaten by a cannibal, or being in a typhoon, or being, you know, that you have to find a motivation for your fear, but you want to change it up. You don't want it to always be the same level of fear, because you're reacting to a different situation every single time.
Sure.
And so in that episode, I can't remember what horrible thing was supposed to happen to Sarah and Jake. But they were just about to call action. And I turned to Stephen and I said, okay, this time I don't care. I don't care if we get eaten by cannibals. I don't care.
It's like a whole different approach.
It wasn't what I chose, you know, it wasn't. But I was joking with Stephen, you know, saying, okay, Sarah's at the point where cannibals? Oh, fine, I've done that, you know. Typhoon? Oh, yeah, we can handle that one. You know, a giant squid eating us? We got that covered. But because it was so much to have to do.
Sure.
Like I said, I didn't choose not caring. Of course not. You'll never see Sarah not caring.
Right.
But it was just a joke to Stephen. So what else can I tell you?
Well, it's got to be a challenge, you know, when you're on a show where, like I said, if you're on ER or something like that, you're being faced with challenges that exist in normal day. You know, people actually see these challenges on a day-to-day basis. But like you said, you have to face cannibals. Who faces cannibals? You know, and who's in the middle of a hurricane once a week? You know, I mean, there's people in hurricanes, sure, but chances are you haven't been trapped in a hurricane, you know, so you have to pull up emotions and reactions that you never in your a million years would ever come across in reality. So that's got to be even more difficult, just to react to something that you have no concept of what the fear would actually be like.
Oh, yes, you're right. Yeah, it was really challenging. But you see, I was really blessed because I was working with the best. And I was surrounded by the best, and from Stephen to Roddy to Jeff, Martin Dubois. I mean, I was working with the best actors, the best cinematographer, the best directors, and so I mean, I remember in the pilot. No, not in the pilot. That's right. It was the first. Was it in the pilot? Huh? I'm trying to remember. We called it the scene at the door because Don loved what happened in that scene between Jake and I, and that was because of Ray Austin, who was the director. And it was the scene where it must have been in Hawaii that we shot this, but I remember it being on the set of the Monkey Bar. I don't know. It has been a long time. But if you go back to either the pilot or the first episode, there's the scene where Jake and Sarah, she comes up to his room, and I believe it was a scene, it was when they were first meeting, and she knocks on the door, but it's the first time you see the sexual attraction between the two of them, and the fact that, we might have a romance here. And And I knock on the door, and the first, we only did, we didn't do more than three takes. And I think we actually only did two. And it was the second take that got into the show. And I remember we did the scene, and then Ray gave me this wonderful direction, and he said, no, remember, I want you to respond to the clap of thunder, because there's a storm coming. So add that into the performance. He said, everything else is really good. But just add that little bit of response into the clap of thunder and lightning. So I did. And it really made a difference. So it was, it was that attention to detail that I was so blessed to be able to work with a director that knew that. Because, you know, oftentimes one of my biggest complaints when I go to a play or a movie is that, okay, they're talking about cockroaches flying around the room, but they're not responding to them. I mean, if cockroaches are flying around the room, they should be getting in your hair, they should be crawling up your leg, they should be, you know, on the forehead of the person you're talking to, so you smack their forehead and then say, oh my God, I'm so sorry, but there was a cockroach. You know what I mean? There should be...
Sure.
There should be some reaction to the fact that, you know, supposedly there's all these cockroaches flying around the room.
Yeah, I've seen movies before where people are running around in the rain, and you can tell that the rain was digitally added in and they were just wet. And they're not blinking or anything, like the rain's hitting them in the eyes. You can tell that they're just wet running around with fake rain.
Right, exactly. I know. I'll scream at the TV screen, the movie screen, when people are doing scenes where they're supposed to be driving a car and having a conversation with the passenger. And they're not even driving the car. They keep looking at the passenger, and it's like, hello, you would have definitely, like, hit something at this point, because you're not driving the car. You're not responding to what would be on the road in front of you.
Then you got the opposite extreme, too, like when somebody's moving the car, like they're rocking it to make it look like it's driving down the street. And they're rocking it so much, it's like, are you driving on a train track? What are you doing? I mean, this thing is bouncing all over the place.
I know. It's true.
So now, as much fun as Tales of the Gold Monkey was, and as much as you got to learn on that show, that was not your first rodeo. I'm looking here on the IMDb, and it looks like the first thing you have listed on here is a TV series called Apple Pie.
Oh, my God. With the fabulous Norman Lear, who I'm just so pleased we're still friends. I just spoke to him recently, and oh my God. You know, when I used to watch All in the Family, right?
Oh, yeah. Good show.
And this, you have to remember, way back when, in the Ice Age, somewhere I'm from, the last century, as an actor at Juilliard, being classically trained, TV was considered a step down, okay?
Sure, I get that. I understand that.
Right. So back in the dark ages of 1978, nobody wanted to do TV, but I wanted to work with Norman Lear, because watching All in the Family blew me away. Oh my God, the writing and the direction and the ensemble cast. And it was produced by this amazing guy named Norman Lear, right? So when my agent called me, and I was out in L.A., and he said, blah, 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 Apple Pie, and it's produced by Norman Lear, I said, yes! Oh, my God, this guy's a genius! I have to work with him! And then, so I went in, and it took place in the 1930s, and the premise was, Rue McClanahan, bless you, Rue. Love you, Rue, because Rue has since passed over. Rue McClanahan played a woman during the Depression, not the 1930s, I was wrong, played a woman during the Depression that believed, and this is so Norman, I mean, my God, this is so Norman, that believed that a family was not necessarily made up of people who were blood relatives. They were made up of people, and this brings tears to my eyes, that supported each other's dreams. As long as those dreams didn't involve hurting other people or animals or the planet, you supported that dream, even if it sounded really crazy to you. So she was at the point that the pilot opens, and this was a sitcom, by the way. Tales of the Gold Monkey, of course, was shot on film. So this was a sitcom. And so that shot, like, on a Friday after 4 days of rehearsal in front of a live audience. So it was very much like doing theater. I loved it. But anyway, so by the time that the show opened, Rue's character, Ginger Nell, had already found the grandfather, played by the amazing Jack Guilford. She had found me, Anna Marie Hollyhock, and my dream was that I wanted to go to Hollywood and join Busby Berkeley as a tap dancer. But I also was, I'm probably going to offend people here, I was a Jesus freak, okay? And so I would always tap dance to different prayers.
Tap dancing to prayers, that's interesting.
Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray to Lord my soul to keep. I would tap dance. Anna Marie was always tap dancing to different prayers and stuff. But anyway, and Michael Binder, the fabulous Michael Binder, he played my brother. I can't remember what his dream was. Ron Lieberman, he played the older brother. So at that point, she was looking for a husband. And in the pilot, it was Michael, he was so good. Michael, I can't remember his name. It was like an Irish name, Michael Mick something. He was so good. And what happened was that at my audition, I had never tap danced, but I always wanted to tap dance. And I read once for Rue and Norman. They didn't ask me to do any tap dancing. And then they called me back, which I just was over the moon about. And I came back again. And this was the most magical experience. And Peter Bonners, who was the director, later concurred with me that it was the same for him. This was the most magical experience that I've ever had. We were completely a family. We loved each other. And so when I came in, there was a total spark between Rue and me and Norman and me and Rue and Norman and blah, blah, blah. And Norman then said to me after I read, come over here. Let me see your time step. And I thought, oh, God, I've got to pretend I can do a time step. So I kind of like did what I kind of remembered tap dancers doing. And Rue said, no, that was really good. That was a great time step. So they cast me, and then they sent me. Now, I swear to God, I believe it was Donald O'Connor. I could be wrong. Maybe Donald O'Connor had already passed over. Remember Donald O'Connor? Do you remember that name?
The name is very familiar, yes.
Because he was a tap dancer. He was a dancer way back, like in the 20s and 30s and 40s and all that. I swear to God, they sent me to Donald O'Connor in L.A., where I took tap dancing lessons. And I remember him saying that I did the fastest time step that he had ever seen, which was a compliment. And it got me, I still have my tap shoes and all that. But anyway, so we shot the pilot, and we all were just so excited. And it got picked up. And they bought 13 episodes. We aired, they bought 13. We shot 7. And they aired 3. And we shot it in a studio at MGM Studios. And now, I'd been out of Juilliard since 74. I was at Juilliard from 70 to 74. So I was out of Juilliard. I was in group 3. And Robin Williams was in group 5 or 6. Now, Robin had just gotten out of Juilliard too, right? And coincidentally, he was shooting a pilot in the studio next door to mine at MGM. His pilot was called Mork and Mindy.
Loved it. Loved it.
So Robin and I would bump into each other in the hallway, like between our scenes. And we would sit there and we would be giggling and laughing and going, oh my God, we each got a pilot. Oh my God, we each got a pilot. This is so cool. This is so cool. Well, of course, ABC picked up only, I think it was only ours, Apple Pie and Mork and Mindy. And then they canceled one of them.
One of them?
Yes, one of them. I think you know which one. Yes. And, I mean, bless Robin because he deserved it and he's, well, I was about to say something on air that you would probably have to bleep out, but he was friggin' brilliant. Let's just put it that way. And he is friggin' brilliant, and he deserved every single minute of it and every single bit of it. And his new show right now, The Crazy Ones, is fantastic. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
I have not had a chance to see that yet, but I do need to see it because I do love Robin Williams. And I, speaking of that, since you got there to talk to him, just one little question about Robin Williams. Does he turn it off ever? Because I've been told that he doesn't really turn it off. Like, when the camera stops rolling, Robin Williams continues to be Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I remember in the halls at Juilliard, and I would be completely bewildered because he would come up to me and start talking to me, but he would be doing, he goes so fast. It's like, hello, did you take a black Cadillac today? I mean, what is the deal? How many cups of coffee are you on? And he's so funny. But you have to remember that once Mork and Mindy took off, I didn't bump into him until just last year.
Wow.
We both were at Juilliard for this tribute to our wonderful teacher, Robert Williams. And I walked up to him and I said, hi. And he was like, oh my God. I said, I know. It's been a while. And he said, yes. And I said, you owe me. And he said, yeah, I know. That was my lotto ticket, wasn't it? And I said, yeah, but you deserved it. You absolutely deserved it. But no, I actually did have a conversation about doing a project together. I told him how much I wanted to do a certain project with him. And he did turn it off for just a few seconds. But usually, you know, his brain is going. In fact, on The Crazy Ones, they air outtakes and they air behind-the-scenes footage at the end of the show. So you can see that he's got everybody cracking up on the set.
Hilarious guy. Hilarious guy.
Yeah.
And the improvisational skills. I mean, come on. How many times I've seen him do a stand-up routine where I couldn't see any glimpse of a handwritten script, like, you know, like he has material that he's going to come out on the stage with. No, he comes out on stage and he looks at the crowd and goes, that's my material, and just runs with it. It's amazing how somebody can do that.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, Wayne Brady does that too, you know.
I mean, yes, he does.
Brilliant also. Yeah, I love it. I mean, it's a lot of fun to do. You just keep going. They kind of hone that in improv class at acting school, you know, Juilliard and other acting schools.
You can teach somebody the theory of that, but if you don't have that spark to be able to do that, I mean, you can tell somebody the theory of how to improv and do that kind of stuff, but unless you have it, it's just not going to come off natural like it does with him.
Well, you know, that's how I got into Juilliard, by the way, was by doing improv.
Then you've got it too.
Excuse me?
I said, well, then you've got that too. That whatever it takes.
Yeah, because when I auditioned for John Houseman, this wonderful, incredibly generous taskmaster, but oh my God, was he amazing. Love you, John. When I auditioned for him and Michael Caan, I was 16 when I, no, I was 17 when I auditioned, I think, yeah. And they said later I gave the worst audition they'd ever seen, which I believe because I had never read Shakespeare in my life, and I thought that it was all full of typos. So I kind of reinterpreted the text because I thought some words were kind of misspelled and stuff, and so I didn't understand the Elizabethan language. And when I looked up during my Juliet speech, they were giggling. They were practically wetting their pants. They were laughing so hard. But when I finished, they said, wait. We want you to do 3 improvs. And I said, oh, okay. And I wasn't quite sure what an improv was. But they said, we want you to sing Happy Birthday 3 different ways. I said, okay, I can do that. And they said, the first way is to somebody who is dying and doesn't know it. And this will be their last birthday.
Wow, that was challenging.
Yeah, but I did it.
Well, sure.
And then the next one was to sing Happy Birthday to the first birthday of my newborn child. And so that was wonderful, and I did that. And then they said, now we want you to sing Happy Birthday as a demonstration. Now, remember, this was my first year was 1970, so it was 1970, right? But it was, you know, we're talking about race riots, and we're talking about the civil rights movement, and we're talking about feminism and all that. And I said, well, as a demonstration, do you want me to demonstrate how to sing Happy Birthday? Or am I supposed to be at a demonstration about birthdays? And they said, well, you choose. So, of course, I did it as if I was at a demonstration for birthdays. I was like marching around the stage. But anyway, they gave me a scholarship based on my raw talent. That's what they told me.
Nice.
And it was those 3 improvs that got me into Juilliard. And it's all because of John Houseman and Michael Kahn that I've had the life I've had and the career I've had and the experiences I've had and the fact that he never lost faith in me ever. So I'm really, really grateful for that.
That is awesome. That is awesome. Also, you've gotten in on the early careers of another actor also. You were in a movie called He Knows You're Alone, and that is rumored to be Tom Hanks' very first movie. And also, as a guest on my show, I have actually had director Armad Mastroianni. I keep messing up the man's name. I'm so bad with it. Mastroianni. I've actually had him on the show, too.
Yeah, Armand Mastroianni.
Yes, thank you, because I'm so bad at that.
Oh, how terrific! Because Armand and I just did an interview for The Hysteria Continues, which comes out of Bristol, England. We just did that, I think, 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago. Yeah. Yeah, He Knows You're Alone, and Tom. Well, you know, Tom had 3 scenes. And actually, we were just on Entertainment Tonight. That was a bizarre thing. I never watch Entertainment Tonight, only because I just don't watch it. But 2 Saturdays ago, I'm not into football, and there was nothing on but football. And so I turned on the TV, and they were doing this feature on stars that began their careers in low-budget horror movies. And I look up, and I see myself on the screen with Tom in the scene, the only scene I had with him, from He Knows You're Alone.
That's cool.
And then they, of course, you know, talked to Tom briefly, and he said how that movie validated him as an actor. And it did for all of us because, as I said to you earlier, when we were chatting, that's the movie that got me into Screen Actors Guild, because as an actor, you have to work and earn points. And so that movie put me over the limit so I could join Screen Actors Guild. And working with Tom, I actually just sent him a message on Facebook. Tom taught me how to act on film, and he doesn't know this. But if you watch He Knows You're Alone, in my opinion, I'm too big for the camera until my scene with Tom. Because remember, I was trained as a stage actress, and as a stage actress, you project to the 15th row.
Right.
And in those days, there were no microphones. You depended on your voice. which was John Houseman was passionate about. And so I had just come off a Pirandello play at Syracuse Stage, and which Pirandello is, the name of the play is To Clothe the Naked. And it's this, of course, completely melodramatic play. And then I went right into He Knows You're Alone. And I suspected that I was a little too big for the camera, and I kept trying to bring it down. But on the day that I shot my scene with Tom, I was standing by the camera, and we were shooting, I think, a previous scene. And I was watching him. And now none of us were stars, so I didn't know who this guy was. We all just basically were unknowns. We just, took the ferry across from New York because we shot it on Staten Island, and we were all having a hoot doing it. And I'm watching him, and I'm thinking, wow, he's not doing anything. I mean, he's not projecting to the 15th row. Of course not. And I thought to myself, wait a minute. Instead of projecting to the 15th row, I've got to think that the audience is sitting on my face.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I did. So then when I had my scene with Tom, which was a very short scene, I brought my energy level down. And then that was a challenge for me then for the rest of the movie, to remember that the audience is basically sitting on my face, and I don't really have to. I can pull it back. And so, in my opinion, I learned that from Tom, and my performance, I believe, improved from that moment on.
That's awesome. When I was talking to Armand, also, he said in his interview that he was watching a interview on television with Tom Hanks, and this was a fairly recent interview too. And the interviewer asked him, "What is your favorite movie?" Expecting to hear him say Big or Castaway or one of these huge blockbusters, and he said, "No, his favorite Tom Hanks movie was that one."
Isn't that wonderful?
His favorite movie, because that's the one that made him. He said that's the one that brought him out and got him going. And he said he will always consider that his favorite movie.
Well, I feel indebted to Tom, because even though I'm the female star of that movie, nobody knew who I was. And yes, we shot that, I believe, in 1980. And then I was really lucky, because then I went on to do, Tales of the Gold Monkey and 3 o'clock High, working with Spielberg and everything, which was a fabulous experience. And, all the TV that I did, and then playing Snow White on The Charmings and all that kind of stuff. But He Knows You're Alone, we got so much attention, after Tom became a star. Because then they would bill it, which was slightly annoying at first, starring Tom Hanks.
Right, that's what they do. That's what they do.
Right, and it was like, hello, please, come on. I am the star. I am the final girl, okay?
It's like Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger were both in Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 3, I think it was. Before anybody knew who they were either, and then when they got big, all of a sudden, then there was this huge boost again to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie again that they wanted to be, disassociated from. But at that point, you got to use them to promote your movie. I mean, they're big now.
Right. And they did. First of all, even before Tom was big, it was so cool. It's kudos to Armand and to Edgar Lansbury and Joe Beru, the producers, that MGM bought our little movie that was shot for nothing on Staten Island. I mean, we didn't even have a costume designer. Those are all our own clothes. It's a sweater I'm wearing when I'm running away from Tom Rolfing, the serial killer, and then I'm stabbing him in the arm. That huge, big, bulky sweater was my boyfriend's. And that was, you know, my jeans, my corduroy pants, my scarf, my hat, everything. We all wore our own clothes. And so it's kudos to Armand and Edgar and Joe that MGM bought this movie. And they flew me out to L.A. to do publicity shots and all that. But it's because Tom became such a huge star. But then our movie really, really got attention. Because you see a movie saying, starring Tom Hanks, oh, you're going to go see that movie.
Sure.
And so I'm really indebted to Tom and to the marketing people that did that, even though, as I said, initially it was a little annoying. Yeah, because now, I can't believe it. He Knows You're Alone is a cult classic.
Right.
It's amazing. I know somebody has emailed me from, they want to know if they can show He Knows You're Alone to raise money for their arts center, and would I come and sign autographs? It's like, sure, of course I will. And so it's this cult classic. And so, and like Tom, I have a real sentimental connection with it, because even though technically it's my second movie, I did another little horror movie, which it was called Savage Weekend, I think. And but in this, in He Knows You Alone, it was so much fun to play opposite Don Scardino, by the way. Don Scardino was absolutely so much fun to work with. Everybody was. Elizabeth Camp, Dana Barron is my little sister. I'm so bad here because I can't remember the name of the actor that played my other love interest. Can't remember his name. But everybody was terrific, and they took really good care of us, and we had such a good time, like I said. So,
well, it's good to know that you can have such a good time doing something that people consider work. You know, it's your job. And I've actually had people on the show before that take it too seriously. You know, I mean, I understand that you got to take it seriously because it's your job and it's your craft, and you have to be very applied to it. But at the same time, it's a fun job, and you got to have fun along the way. And part of that translates into your acting and your characters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things in our acting classes at Juilliard was always, if you're not having fun, the magic isn't going to happen. You have to fall in love with your character. You have to, you know, and as an actor, you have to absolutely enjoy the process of this craft, which I do. I absolutely do. I love being an actress. I love it. I love making people laugh. I got to tell you, my favorite is actually doing comedy, because I there's just something so gratifying when you get that response from the audience. I've got fans on Facebook, and you know, horror movie fans, and they'll send me all this really like graphic horror stuff. And I probably shouldn't say this, but I don't like horror movies really too much because I don't enjoy being frightened. But I had to get over that when I did He Knows You're Alone. And you do. You just, because as I was taught, you have to fall in love with your character and make it fun. And it is. It is. It for me, it's such a high to be able to do what I love and be paid for it. And I think everybody should do that. I mean, I really think that's kind of a maxim for life. I think that if you don't work at a job that you love, oh my God, then you're simply a slave to
exactly.
The fact that you need to pay the rent and all that. You know, you have to find work that you love.
Exactly. Now, what do you enjoy the most, being on a stage, being on in a film, or being on television?
That's such a difficult question, because the mediums are completely different. And I don't mean to be repetitive or redundant, but the feeling of both is exhilarating. To be able to be on a stage, and see, I don't really like the fact that stages are mic'd now. I don't like it. Because I love that physicality of projecting my voice and throwing the character out there to the audience for them to catch and for them to enjoy. It's just so thrilling when you make your entrance from the wings and you don't have to hold back. I don't know, because then when you do film, like I said, you still have to have that same intensity of emotion, but you have to pull it back because the audience is right there. The audience is basically sitting on your nose, looking into your eyes. You know, you have to pull it all back, and so that's a completely different physical feeling. And then when you do a sitcom is done in front of a live audience. So it's like doing theater, but you can't throw it out that far. Because it's still, they're not sitting on your face in a sitcom, but they're halfway there.
So, they're right in front of your face.
Right. I can't say that I love one more than the other. I love all of it. I mean, it's exhilarating and thrilling, and it doesn't matter to me. I mean, if somebody, you know, it doesn't matter to me what I do, as long as I do it.
That's awesome.
If I don't do it, then I'm not happy. But as long as I'm doing it, then I'm happy. You can give me any three, it doesn't matter.
Because I'm noticing here that you've done a lot of television series. There's a lot of them on here, and they're, you know, some pretty big name shows here. I mean, there's some of them that I don't remember, like After MASH. I don't remember that TV series. Clearly a spinoff from the show MASH. Were any of the characters from the original show MASH in the After MASH show?
Oh my God! You say you can't remember it?
I really don't remember it at all. I don't remember that one at all.
I remember that I did it,
and I love MASH.
I don't remember. I'm so sorry. Remember when you do a guest star? It's 5 days of work. That's it.
All right.
I mean, you do an episode. Maybe it's 2 weeks. Maybe it'll spill over, but not usually, because they've got to get out an episode. They've got to crank out an episode every week. So you get the script, you come on, you do the table read, and then boom, you're on the set. And so I remember I would really have to sit down and kind of, you know, drag through those brain cells that hopefully are still alive and you know, pull forth some memories. But at this moment, I wasn't it Alan Alda that did MASH? I can't remember. So I'm so sorry. I can't remember.
Well, that's all right. I've seen also that, like I said, there were some big shows that a lot of people remember for sure. Like I'm looking through the list here. We got Silver Spoons. We got St. Elsewhere. Murder, She Wrote. Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
L.A. Law. I mean, you're all Alien Nation. I love Alien Nation. I'm Alien Stone. It's Inside the Mothership. You know I love that show.
Yes, of course. Oh, yeah. And Murder, She Wrote. I remember I was just so impressed by Angela Lansbury, because she was not a star. And she hung out with the guest stars, which I loved. And I was just so blown away by that. Because I have worked with certain people that, you know, they look down on you because you're the guest star. And they treat you like that. But not Angela. Angela was so cool, and she was just, you know, she behaved as if she was just part of the ensemble. That she wasn't the star of the show, which I loved. Yeah, she was terrific.
Yeah, I love it when I get people like that, that they're big and they're huge, but they don't act big and huge, you know, because they want to be normal people. They want to sit there and talk to a person on a intimate level, a person-to-person level. They don't want to be talking down to somebody and somebody else talking up to them. Those are the kind of people that I want to talk to.
Right. Right. Yeah. And we all started somewhere. You know, we all were waiters at some point. Well, not all of us, but most of those in show business, we all waited tables. until we got our shot, until we got our break. So, yeah. So Angela, and remember now, it's very cool, is that it was Angela's brother, Edgar, that produced He Knows You're Alone.
Ooh.
Yeah, see, isn't that cool?
I don't make those connections. That's what I need you for.
Yeah. Well, I have another really cool story, if you want to hear it.
Sure.
It's a personal story, but when I was in high school, I was really, really, really bad in math. I was a straight-A student in biology and English because I loved those subjects. But put me in a math class, my God, I hated it. And in my senior year, I had to take algebra. Well, my God, that was like, I had no clue as to what the teacher was. I couldn't figure it out at all. And so at the end of the year, my teacher, Mr. Hyken, and I went to Whitefish Bay High School in Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. He came up to me in the hallway one day after school, and he said, Kathy, because that's how I was known, of course, Kathy, I saw you in the school play, and I really think you're talented, and I heard that you want to audition for Juilliard. So you flunked every single test this year. So technically, I should be giving you an F, but because Juilliard doesn't look at grades, they only look as to whether you graduated or not, I'm going to give you a D minus so that you can audition for Juilliard. Well, so of course, we know that I got into Juilliard and all that, which was amazing. So then, years later, when I was doing Tales of the Gold Monkey, you come out onto the set at the beginning of every episode, and I would always go and say hello to the guest stars. And so that morning I came out, and there was this guy standing there, and I said, Hi, I'm Caitlin O'Haney, and it's so great. Welcome to the set. We're going to have so much fun this week. And what's your name? And he goes, well, my name is Harold Hyken. I looked at him, and I said, oh, that's really funny. I said, I wouldn't be standing here today if it wasn't for my algebra teacher, who was named Gerald Hyken. And I may have gotten that confused, by the way. It may be that the actor's name was Gerald and the algebra teacher's name was Harold, but I can't remember right now. But let's just say it was the actor's name was Harold and my algebra teacher's name was Gerald. But they both had the last name Hyken. So I told him the story that I just told you, and he looks at me and he goes, I know, because that's my brother.
Wow.
I said, you've got to be kidding me.
Small world. Teeny tiny world.
Yeah. I said, my algebra teacher who gave me a D minus instead of an F so that I have a shot at Juilliard is your brother? And he said, yeah. I said, oh, my God, no wonder he was so supportive of me. He had a brother that wanted to be an actor. He said, yeah, I know. Isn't that cool?
That is very cool. That is very, very cool.
Yes.
So the newest thing that it says here that you're currently still filming it is The Late Phases. You play Emma?
Yes, actually we wrapped that, and I actually was at the Woodstock Film Festival this past fall, seeing a documentary that one of the producers of Late Phases also produced, and his name is Larry Fessenden, and I asked him about the progress of Late Phases, and they'd done the rough cut, and they were very pleased, and Brent Kunkel, and both Brent and Larry have the company Glass Eye Pix, and that's their production company, and they had told me that they were looking forward to submitting it to different festivals in 2014, getting it released in 2014, and that they were very happy with the progress of it. That's all I know. That's all I can tell you.
Well, I will be looking for that for sure. Well, I appreciate you giving me a call here, and it's been a lovely little chat. I do appreciate it. And on behalf of myself and my producer, Michael Klinkenbeard, I again thank you very much. And, yeah, it's been a great conversation.
Well, terrific. Thank you, and thank Michael for me, too. And do you plan on snagging Tom for any kind of an interview? You should try to snag Tom.
I told Michael Klinkerbeard, I said, well, hey, we've got the director. We've got another actor from that. Why don't you just get me Tom Hanks? He goes, oh, yeah, I'll get right on that. So we'll see how that works. That would be awesome. That would be...
Well, Tom's got a page on Facebook. You know, Facebook him.
Sure.
Right? Shoot him a message or something on Facebook. Who knows?
And while I'm at it, I'll go for Tom Hanks, too, and tell him that you sent me, or Tom Hanks and Robin Williams. I'll send them for both of them and say, you sent me.
That's right. If I were you, I would do that, too, and tell Robin that I give him a big hug. And but anyway, this has been a lot of fun, Alien Stone, and it was terrific meeting you and chatting with you, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. My guest, Caitlin O'Haney. I thank you very much. It's been a lovely time, and you have a great and fantastic day.
Oh, I will. You brightened it, so thank you. You have a great day, too. All right. I look forward to hearing the interview on the show.